Welcome everyone to our last 3CL seminar of this academic term. It is a great pleasure introducing Professor Aurelio Guerrero Martinez of Singapore Management University. At Singapore Management University, Aurelio is head of the Singapore Global Restructuring Initiative. And I should add that 3CL has been cooperating with the Singapore Global Restructuring Initiative for a couple of years. In particular, we were running a couple of roundtables successfully together, which we've also published online. Aurelio has been a visiting professor at, in particular, Reichman University, the University of Chicago in 2023 and 2022. He is a research member of the European Corporate Governance Institute, and he has a long list of honors and awards. I will just mention one of them. He has received the Cross-Border Insolvency Academic of the Year Award by the Global Restructuring Review last year. His research areas are in corporate insolvency law, corporate governance, law and finance, and fintech. And I like in particular to point out his book published with Cambridge University Press in 2024 on reinventing insolvency law in emerging economies. Aurelio, we are very happy to have you here today with us. You are a great speaker, but also academic friend of 3CL and us. So it's really great to have you here. You'll speak to us on insolvency law in the Global South. And I think the way that you will look at this will be also taking a broader approach in terms of what the Global North can learn from the Global South and what we can learn in a comparative law context. So I'm very pleased to have you here. I'm very grateful that you're coming to Cambridge to speak to us. And I'm looking forward to your presentation, Aurelio. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Professor Steffek, for your always kind introduction. It's an immense honor to be here, not only for the opportunity to present my research at the University of Cambridge, but also for the opportunity to present my research before such an amazing audience of many people that I truly admire, so many role models in academia, many promising academics that I can see in the audience as well, many PhD students, doctoral students. I had the opportunity to talk to some of them. So my sincere gratitude to the University of Cambridge for the invitation, and particularly to the Center for Corporate and Commercial Law. And the topic that I'm going to present today is a topic that is actually very close to my heart, because as Professor Steffek has mentioned, in the past few years, I've been working on different projects that has been, some of them have been covering like jurisdictions in about 80 countries around the world. And one of them was the book that Professor Steffek mentioned on the need to reinvent insolvency law in emerging economies. So for that particular project, I've been focusing on about 50 jurisdictions. And I've learned a lot from what I've studied in different emerging economies. And the other project is a global insolvency index that I've built. So initially I was covering about 80 jurisdictions. Now in the final phase of the project, I've reduced that to about 60 jurisdictions because I haven't been able to get enough accurate information from certain countries. But the key message is that I've learned a lot from those projects, and that made me realize that sometimes the Global South is not properly represented in many academic debates, not only in insolvency, but also in corporate law, financial regulation, securities laws, other areas of law. And also, because I've learned a lot, I think that there are some interesting lessons that we can learn from kind of this research project that I've conducted. And they have been also partially inspired by a work that Professor Mariana Pargendler from Harvard Law School has done. Actually, the title is quite similar, the initial part of the title, insolvency in the Global South, because she has written significantly about corporate law and corporate governance in the Global South. And her main thesis was that basically the Global South has innovated in certain aspects of corporate law and corporate governance, sometimes because of the need to innovate, because the Global South often faces some institutional problems and problems of inequality that maybe might require more creativity when it comes to legal solutions. So that's why I started this project, by combining both Mariana Pargendler's work which is called like Legal Heterodoxy in the Global South and led to a book recently published, and my own research on comparative and international insolvency law. And I was trying to explore whether that is something that we can learn from the Global South or not, and if so, what? And then to see whether the Global North can actually learn something from the Global South. Because the starting point here, and by the way, I know that many of you are not interested in insolvency. At the same time, we have many leading insolvency scholars, so it's kind of difficult sometimes to adjust this type of a speech to an audience with both profiles, like all the top insolvency scholars, and at the same time, some people that have told me before the seminar that they came, but they are not necessarily people interested in insolvency. The good news for those of you who are not interested in insolvency is that the main takeaway of this project and my presentation is that this is not about insolvency. This is more about global research, global education, and actually the type of education that you get at Cambridge, which is having a global mindset, thinking about global problems. Sometimes we all face the same problems everywhere. And by studying how different countries adopt a particular policy solution, a regulatory approach to address a particular problem, we all can learn from each other. So that's why the real message here is not the insolvency message. It's the message that maybe there is something that we can learn from the Global South, and we are often missing the opportunity to learn from those solutions precisely because we often focus on the same jurisdictions, typically from the Global North. So when we think about insolvency, but again, the same applies to many other areas of law, we can see an interesting trend, which is solutions, practices, proceedings from the Global North inspire proceedings, solutions in the Global South. So in the insolvency context, so for example, some of you are familiar with the UK insolvency system, and if not, I strongly encourage you to take the course with Professor Stefek and Professor Louis Gallifer here to learn more about insolvency law in the UK. But actually, if you look at insolvency laws in Nigeria, in Ghana, in Kenya, so it's very similar. They have also a scheme of arrangement. They have an administration proceeding. So you can see many similarities. For those of you who have studied, for example, insolvency law in Singapore, so then the good news is that if you want to know more about insolvency law in Malaysia, the good news is that you already know, because Malaysia has literally replicated the insolvency regime from Singapore. So it's basically the same regime, but with a more powerful moratorium in the scheme of arrangement, and with a CBA, like the UK CBA, Company Voluntary Arrangement, which is a proceeding that doesn't exist in Singapore, and Malaysia has that. But apart from that, basically the same. So China and Thailand have adopted many provisions from Chapter 11 from the US. So for example, the cross-class cramdown, the possibility of imposing a plan on dissenting classes of creditors, that was kind of invented in the US, and that has been imported in many jurisdictions around the world, in both the Global South and the Global North, because the European Union now has adopted the cross-class cramdown as well. The UK has adopted cross-class cramdown, Singapore, but also many jurisdictions in the Global South. And also Thailand has a debtor in possession model for the governance of insolvency proceedings inspired by the US Chapter 11. Brazil has adopted many provisions also from the Global North, mainly from Chapter 11. So for example, now in Brazil, in 2020, they amended the law to provide new priorities for new lenders, so kind of the deep financing regime existing in the United States. Also, creditors can submit competing reorganization plans, as happens in the US. But also, the original design of the Brazilian insolvency regime is very much inspired by the French regime, the European proceeding. So that's why, again, Brazil got the inspiration from the Global North as well. And Uruguay has an insolvency regime that basically replicates an insolvency bill that was discussed in Spain in the 90s. So that's why the common trend here is that the Global North is influencing the Global South. We cannot see, or at least I haven't seen in my research, the opposite, which is the Global South inspiring solutions in the Global North. And actually, that's interesting because that is leading to a kind of global convergence in the design of insolvency law. So in the corporate law space, I know there are many people here doing corporate law. So there has been a lot of discussion on whether we are observing this convergence in the design of corporate law. Professor Krackman and Hansman also wrote significantly about that, and then many other scholars have been debating about that. But in insolvency, we are seeing that convergence. And then from the at least from the perspective of the law on the books. So we can see, for example, that many countries around the world, the UK, European Union, Singapore, they are all adopting provisions from Chapter 11. So now more similarities across jurisdiction. We can see the rise of hybrid proceedings. By hybrid proceedings, I mean the type of preventive restructuring frameworks that the European Union has adopted. Many countries, for example, in Africa, Ethiopia has adopted these preventive restructuring frameworks. Many countries in Latin America have adopted these preventive restructuring frameworks. We can see the rise of pre-PACs. A pre-PAC is basically to try to reach an agreement with your creditors out of court. And once you have all the relevant majorities, you typically file for bankruptcy, you initiate the process, and you can exit the process very quickly. Because filing for bankruptcy is very costly, very time-consuming. So that's why the global trend is to try to reduce the length and costs of insolvency proceedings. And many countries, including Korea, including Singapore, Argentina, Colombia, Chile, Uruguay, they are all adopting this form of pre-PACs. So, but when we look at the forces behind this global convergence in the design of insolvency law, sometimes we see regional challenges or harmonization efforts. The clearest example is the European Union. So in the European Union, the harmonization is not an option, it's a requirement imposed by the European Union. But sometimes regulatory competition is leading to this harmonization, because Singapore adopted a very comprehensive reform in 2017 and 18, in part because Singapore said, we want to be a global hub for debt restructuring. So that's why let's try to adopt all the best practices from the US, from the UK, and let's do that. The UK realized in 2020 that Singapore, European Union, the US were having relatively attractive regimes for debtors. And the UK was a bit behind because the scheme of arrangement was a bit limited. It's no more than a majority rule per each class. And then they said, well, maybe we need a cross-class clampdown. And this is going to be done through a new proceeding, which is the restructuring plan, but also the standalone moratorium, because sometimes while negotiating a scheme or restructuring plan on others, we might need the protection of the moratoriums. That's why the UK, part of the motivation was to modernize the law to compete internationally. Legal origins. So maybe Ghana is looking at the UK, or maybe Malaysia is looking at Singapore, sometimes for legal origins. So for example, when Singapore adopted the comprehensive reform in 2017, there was a report that was published with tentative proposals to improve the regime in Singapore. And most of the proposals and the best practice that were considered came from the UK, from the US, from Australia, interestingly, countries with similar legal origins. So why not, for example, looking at Germany? Or why not, for example, looking at Colombia or Brazil or Chile? So interestingly, in many of these debates, sometimes we look at jurisdictions with the same legal origin. And actually, maybe the key question, or one of the many questions that I've been thinking about, is why is the global north always influencing the global south and not the other way around? Is because of consequences of colonialism and legal origins, that the former colonies are looking at the legal origins, legal solutions, and legal innovations in the global north? Maybe it's because we have more academic and policy debates in the global north. When we look at the number of, for example, full-time academics in the global north and the global south, sometimes in the global south, in certain jurisdictions, there aren't many like insolvency scholars or corporate law scholars. So maybe because we have more debates in the global north, that's why the global north is more influential. Maybe it's because the global south wants to replicate the economic success of the global north. But if that's the reason, that is kind of mixing up correlation with causation, because actually maybe the global north has done incredibly well for reasons that have nothing to do with insolvency regime. And in fact, maybe some jurisdictions in the global north have been doing very well with very inefficient and value-destroying insolvency regimes. So that's why that's not probably the right solution. Maybe it's just because they want to replicate the success of the insolvency regime in the global north. Well, then typically what we learn in a basic comparative law course is that context matters. So that's why we cannot just replicate legal practices from other jurisdictions. So that's why that might not work that well. So that's why, as I mentioned, inspired by Mariana Pagendle's work, the Global South has innovated in corporate law I was wondering whether the same applies to insolvency law. And she said, well, that is something that I observed in my research, that, for example, when it comes to corporate governance, many countries in the Global South, including China, India, Brazil, South Africa, have adopted stakeholder-oriented provisions. Interestingly, many countries in the Global North in the past decade have been discussing about the introduction of a stakeholder-oriented provision. For example, in the UK, Colin Mayer wrote a book speaking and advocating for that. Also in the US, we have people like Martin Lipton and many others that have been advocating for that approach. And actually what Professor Parjendra says is that, well, the Global South has these stakeholder-oriented provisions in part because of some problems with the government, with the state, the institutional environment is relatively weak, cannot provide like effective solutions to citizens, and maybe they have used corporation and corporate directors' duties to try to solve those problems. And also problems of inequality, et cetera. So that's why maybe it's a policy that is supposed to redistribute. It's not the ideal policy in an ideal world, but the Global South doesn't have that ideal world. So maybe that's why they have adopted these responses. And then she said, we are observing the rise of inequality and institutional problems in many countries in the Global North. And maybe that's why the Global North now has become more interested in this solution traditionally existing in the Global South. So I was wondering whether the same kind of logic applies in the insolvency context, and maybe whether we can learn something. Because a very powerful message that Professor Parjendra said is that by looking at the Global South, we can expand our institutional imagination. So, and this is what I've been kind of wondering. And then when I look at the literature on insolvency, we can see that even in comparative studies on insolvency, people typically compare the same jurisdiction, UK and the US. Or if you are from Australia, I can see some people from Australia here, you compare Australia with the UK. Or if you are from Germany, you compare Germany with Chapter 11. And that's all. So that means that, first of all, we are typically comparing countries in the Global North. And actually comparing countries, the same countries in the Global North. And there is an entire universe out there that maybe have some interesting solutions that can help us think about our own insolvency regime. But again, I'm speaking about insolvency here, but that applies to financial regulation, corporate law, private law in general. So maybe that is an interesting solution out there. And by the way, we're speaking about the Global South. That means that we're speaking about 85% of the world's population. So that's why we're speaking about the majority of the world. So that's why I realized that in insolvency, the Global South is not typically covered. And when it is because the author is from that jurisdiction. For example, Brazil has had more scholars writing about that. Also in the past few years, we have seen more studies covering China and India, but the rest of the Global South is basically ignored. So in my own research, I've missed having more information and more knowledge from insolvency law in the Philippines, insolvency law in Cambodia, but unfortunately I haven't seen many research in many of those countries. So why are we so obsessed with insolvency law in the Global North, and particularly with Chapter 11? Because Chapter 11 is influencing insolvency reforms everywhere. It's such a paradise. I mean, Chapter 11 is the gold standard. Interestingly, most countries around the world admire US Chapter 11. But when you ask the people in the US, many people have been saying that Chapter 11 should be abolished. Should be abolished because it's very costly. Actually, Professor Lucian Bebchuk, one of the first articles that he wrote before writing more about corporate governance, he wrote significantly about bankruptcy. And he suggested some radical solutions to get rid of many of the frictions that Chapter 11 create because of all the valuation disputes and all the disputes for the purpose of dividing the pie. Because Chapter 11 has two main problems. One is about maximizing the pie, and the other is about dividing the pie. So the same problem exists in most insolvency regimes, but in Chapter 11, achieving these two goals are very costly. So that's why many people, like Professor Robert Rasmussen, Alan Schwarz, Douglas Byrd, they all have been suggesting, why not using auctions instead of formal reorganization proceedings just to sell the company to the highest bidder? Why not using options instead of auctions as well for the purpose of allocating the value of the pie? Why not using creative contractual solutions, which is what Alan Schwarz and Robert Rasmussen and many others have been suggesting. So the US has been heavily criticized in the US. Interestingly, in the rest of the world, they look at the US with admiration. And then when we look at insolvency regimes in other global north jurisdictions, again, we have people from Australia here. So the Australian Treasury Department recently commissioned that report saying, well, we may need to revisit our insolvency regime, and the conclusion of the report that was supposed to recommend solutions for the improvement of the insolvency regime in Australia, the recommendation is that the insolvency system needs to be redesigned, basically. So it needs to be reinvented. So that is Australia. And New Zealand is the same situation because New Zealand adopted many of the provisions from Australia. And the UK, again, in 2020, realized that in order to remain competitive, had some needed to implement certain reforms. Spain adopted a very comprehensive reform in 2022, but until then, Spain was one of the countries, one of the advanced economies with the lowest levels of bankruptcy proceedings in the world. So why insolvency proceedings were not commonly used in Spain? In part, one of the explanations is that they were not very attractive to debtors and creditors, and they were all avoiding the insolvency process either ex ante by reducing the level of debt or risk-taking, or ex post by using alternative mechanisms. So France is very popular for debtors, but it's a very creditor unfriendly regime. So, and studies by Julian Franks and Davidenko and others have shown that obtaining credit in France is more costly because the system is not attractive to secure creditors. And it can continue. Singapore now has a very modern, sophisticated insolvency regime, but still the stigma of insolvency is there. So insolvency proceedings and becoming insolvent is still very stigmatized. So that's why maybe the global north is not the paradise that we often envision. So that's why that reminds me to something that the new generations have all kind of been using these kind of drawings to describe the reality versus the perception. And it seems that the global south is often looking at the global north with this admiration, looking at the very nice horse that you can see here. But the reality of the global north is maybe not that perfect ideal solution that the global south often ambitions. So then my question and then my research was, okay, let's explore more the global south and whether they have adopted some interesting solutions that maybe can inspire, who knows, solutions in the global north. And actually, when we think about the main problems of insolvency proceedings in the global north, I've summarized some of them: costly and lengthy proceeding. So in every country where I've been speaking about insolvency law, I've never heard in a single country, oh, insolvency proceedings are incredibly efficient and they are not disruptive at all. No, it's always the same. Lengthy proceedings, costly proceedings, disruptive proceedings everywhere. Stigma, even in the US. You don't wake up in the morning and say, oh, I would love to file for bankruptcy. Makes me so happy to do that. No, I mean, if you file for bankruptcy, it's because you really need it. And then the system is useful. And in fact, you can even become president of the United States after being bankrupt a couple of times. So that's why, I mean, insolvency law is less stigmatized in the US, but still it has the stigma. And then many countries complain, Australia and New Zealand, about the need to reform the insolvency law, because maybe in Australia and New Zealand, the law is very attractive to secure creditors, but it's not very attractive to debtors and to unsecured creditors. France, the opposite, very attractive to debtors, but very unattractive to secure creditors. So sometimes many countries don't have the proper balance here. So the point is, all of these problems are often exacerbated, particularly the cost and length of insolvency proceedings in the global south. That means that they have even more incentives to think about creative solutions to address those problems. So the question is, if the global south have been dealing with those problems, and the global south represent 85% of the world's population, maybe, and just maybe, they came up with some solutions to deal with those problems that exist also in the global north. So why not learning from each other? That's why what I did in this paper that is now going to be published in the American Journal of Comparative Law is to identify some of the most innovative solutions that I've seen around the world, particularly in the global south, that maybe can inspire solutions, not only in other jurisdictions in the global south, but even more shocking for many people from the global north, for the global north itself. So maybe, hopefully, who knows, we might end up observing a reverse convergence in the design of insolvency law, where solutions from the global south might end up inspiring solutions in the global north and not the other way around. And just to mention some specific examples. So during the Asian financial crisis in the late 90s, many Asian countries didn't have efficient insolvency regimes. And the judiciary was very inefficient as well. So then they were wondering, how can we deal with the wave of insolvency cases if we don't have an effective, efficient insolvency regime? They became very creative. And Thailand, for example, said, well, we need to incentivize debtors and creditors to negotiate out of court. How can we do it? Let's provide some tax incentives for debtors and creditors. Because when you reach an agreement with your creditor, that's called a haircut in insolvency, then if you reach a kind of, you give a debt forgiveness, the debt forgiveness is supposed to be kind of a gift for the debtor. And that gift, from an accounting perspective, is an income in most jurisdictions, and you need to pay taxes for that income. So the tax authorities in Thailand said, no, that's not going to be an income for tax purposes. So then debtors are going to be more incentivized to reach these agreements out of court. But at the same time, in many countries, tax authorities require some collection efforts from the perspective of the creditors in order to deduct the losses, that because a debt forgiveness implies a loss for the creditors. So that's why, but if you voluntarily reach the agreement with the debtor, you are not showing the collection efforts. So that's why Thailand said, don't worry, you're going to be deducting your losses also from this haircut. So, and apart from that, Malaysia, for example, what they did is to create a framework similar to the London approach in the UK, but in Thailand, it was more regulated, led by the Central Bank of Malaysia. And basically, they created an environment where debtors and creditors were able to negotiate out of court with certain tools existing in formal insolvency proceedings, but again, without using the judiciary. And actually, it has become very successful. And even the IMF has said that Malaysia has one of the most sophisticated frameworks for out-of-court restructuring in the world. So why do we need to promote out-of-court restructuring in the global north? Because sometimes using the formal insolvency process, in most cases, is very costly, very lengthy. And in many cases, companies, particularly most European countries, for example, and even some companies in the UK, companies have concentrated debt structure, meaning that maybe they don't have the type of thousands of creditors that many US corporations have. So if you don't have many creditors, it's going to be much easier to reach an agreement out of court. You only need the right environment, the right incentives to do that. And if you do it, you can save all the cost, money, time, resources of using the formal insolvency process. So maybe the Global North can learn some valuable lessons from the Global South, and particularly from those jurisdictions that have been promoting workouts. Also in the US, the US now has this debate on whether financial distress should be required for the initiation of an insolvency process. In many countries around the world, you need to be insolvent or in likelihood of insolvency or imminent insolvency in order to initiate the process. The US doesn't require that. So you can initiate the process very quickly, automatically getting the bankruptcy protection, but the case can be terminated, dismissed, exposed, sometimes for lack of good faith. And some courts have interpreted the lack of financial distress as lack of good faith. So the question, Johnson & Johnson, for example, is one of the companies that filed for bankruptcy and the case was terminated because of that. So the US is now debating and litigating a lot about that. It's creating litigation costs, it's creating uncertainty. So my proposal for the US is to look at Uruguay. They came up with a fantastic solution to deal with this problem. They said, well, if the process is initiated by the debtor, they initially said, well, insolvency is required, but if it is initiated by the debtor, then that is a non-rebuttable presumption of insolvency. So meaning, because I mean, you are not going to file voluntarily for bankruptcy. It's like you are not going to go to the hospital if you don't need to go to the hospital. So if you go and you are going to be bearing the cost of filing for bankruptcy, you probably need that process. So why not allowing you to have access to the hospital quickly without asking you whether you are dead or not? So why not allowing you, and if you are using the hospital opportunistically, Uruguay allows the termination of the process. In fact, a majority of unsecured creditors that are supposed to have more skin in the game here because they are supposed to be the residual claimants of the insolvent firm, a majority of them can terminate the process and to put the company in liquidation. So that threat is already a very powerful one. So maybe something like that can inspire certain reforms in the United States to deal with the current litigation and uncertainty. Also another problem currently observed in the US that has been documented by Professor Jared Elias, Kenny Yott, and a few others, that we typically think about Chapter 11 as a process led by management, by the directors. But then a few couple of decades ago, Professor Ed Morrison and also Ken Ayotte showed that secure creditors were the most powerful actors in Chapter 11, so not the debtor anymore. And interestingly, what the recent most recent research has shown is that deep lenders, those extending credit to the financially distressed firms, are the ones often dominating the bankruptcy process. Because basically they say, well, you need my money, but if you want my money, then I want to impose many conditions here. And I'm going to be dictating, which is what Jared Elias, Ken Ayotte, and others have documented, I'm going to be imposing, dictating certain terms that might lead to both an inefficient outcome in bankruptcy, maybe inefficient liquidations, but at the same time, a violation of priorities, because sometimes they favor themselves at the expense of other creditors. So the question is, how can the US deal with this problem, the potential cost created by these powerful deep lenders? The solution was provided in Chile and in India or in the Dominican Republic. So in these countries, the new financing needs to be approved directly or indirectly, there are different rules, by the creditors. Because why do we allow debtors to obtain new financing, sometimes even priming existing liens in the US? The rationale behind the deep financing regime is that you obtain the new financing and the pre-existing creditors are going to be paid after the new lender, only because the new financing is supposed to create or preserve value. So in other words, it's supposed to create a Pareto improvement. It's supposed to make all the pre-existing creditors better off. That's why we authorize the priority. The question is, well, if the pre-existing creditors are indeed better off, why not asking them what they think about that? In Chile, if you obtain a deep loan that exceeds 20% of the value of the debtor assets, you need to ask the creditors whether they want to approve the loan or not. Because again, they're going to be paid after the deep lender. In India, the new financing needs to be approved by the committee of creditors. Dominican Republic has my preferred approach. So I've been saying that Chapter 11 should be inspired by the Dominican Republic when it comes to deep financing, of course, with some adjustments. Because in the Dominican Republic, the judge will approve the new financing. And I think, just to be clear, there are many advantages because the judge will have the ability to reduce asymmetries of information, to oversee the whole process, to assess everything. But the judge doesn't have sometimes skin in the game there. So the pre-existing creditors are the ones that are going to benefit or might end up worse off by the approval of the new financing. So that's why in the Dominican Republic, the judge approves, but the creditors can challenge the approval of the new financing and they can tell the judge, I don't want you to approve that. And so they can veto the approval of new financing. So I think it's a very balanced approach that maybe the US can consider. Also, we have this debate in the UK, Australia, about whether administration should lead to the replacement of the management and the appointment of a new administrator. That approach exists in most jurisdictions with administration-style proceedings. So in my view, that stigmatizes a situation of insolvency because that assumes that the management has done something wrong, and that's not necessarily the case. It also might increase the cost, the direct cost of insolvency proceedings because we need to pay an administrator for doing that job. And that's why during the pandemic, the UK popularized this idea of light touch administration that became more popular in part is to keep the management, but then an administrator just monitoring instead of replacing the management. So surprise, surprise, that solution already existed in the global south. Most countries in Latin America had the light touch approach that the UK embraced. So Chile, Colombia, Brazil, they all appoint an administrator, but the administrator doesn't replace the management. So my preferred approach here, and I'm very glad that I can see some doctoral students from Colombia, and many colleagues and friends from Colombia as well. My preferred approach here is Colombia, because Colombia has a debtor in possession model, which is the US approach for Chapter 11. So yes, it's a solution imported from the global north, but imported from the global north with some adjustments. And this adjustment is like if the creditors themselves don't like the management, 30% of the non-conflicted creditors can request the appointment of an external administrator. And at the same time, based on the complexity of the case or the cross-border nature of the case, et cetera, the superintendents of companies, which is the entity in charge of overseeing insolvency proceedings in Colombia, can also appoint an external administrator. So the default rule is debtor in possession. But an external administrator can be appointed if it is needed because of the complexity of the case, cases of fraud, mismanagement, et cetera, or just because the creditors don't trust the management and the controlling shareholders and they want to appoint someone. So I think this is a solution that maybe is worth exploring in countries like Australia or the UK, even in the context of administration. And it can continue. There are many solutions. I'm just going to mention only one more, which is the stigma of insolvency, because that's a problem existing everywhere. So my advice here for both Global North and Global South is to look at Chile. So Chile adopted a very comprehensive insolvency reform in 2014. So before that, Chile used to have about 200 insolvency proceedings in total. Right now, Chile has thousands of insolvency proceedings and, well, adopting many reforms. So first of all, discharge for entrepreneurs was not allowed. So Chile adopted a new personal insolvency regime. And now many of the insolvency cases are individuals, consumers that cannot pay their debts. That's, of course, one of the reasons explaining the increase. But even in the context of corporation, the cases have been multiplied by four in Chile in the past decade, precisely because, first of all, the regime is now more appealing to both debtors and creditors. And secondly, focusing on the stigma, because for the stigma, to be honest, sometimes insolvency is stigmatized for the right reasons, because sometimes the proceeding is very unattractive. Or in many countries like Australia, for example, or Singapore, if you become bankrupt and you want to travel overseas, you need the approval from your insolvency regulator. So that's why, or for example, in Ecuador, if you become bankrupt, you are not eligible to work for the public sector. In many countries in Asia, if you become bankrupt, you are automatically disqualified to become a corporate director, regardless of the reason for becoming bankrupt. If that is fraud or mismanagement, fine, but any reason. So all of these rules, not necessarily insolvency rules, but insolvency-related rules, are stigmatizing the situation of insolvency. In, for example, Spain, so if you end up in bankruptcy, in liquidation, you can be liable in certain cases for the company's debts. But those liability regimes don't exist in formal reorganization. So that's why we can see that. But in Chile, the most interesting thing that I think led to a change in the mindset is that the institution in charge of overseeing insolvency proceedings was to be named the Superintendent of Bankruptcy. And now the name is Superintendent of Insolvency and Re-Entrepreneurship. Basically, now what they are doing is to emphasize what insolvency law really does, which is to reallocate resources in the economy to facilitate the transition, sometimes from non-viable businesses toward more the reallocation of the debtor assets and to put them to better uses, and to tell people that you're not becoming bankrupt. You are just a re-entrepreneur transitioning from one activity to another. So Chile has been invested a lot in changing the mindset, but that led to certain regulatory and institutional reforms. And in only 10 years, so Chile has basically almost got rid of the stigma of insolvency. So just to conclude, I want to emphasize by saying, well, here you have three people. You have Plato, the philosopher. You have Albert Einstein, and then you have Professor Mariana Pargendler. So they all said similar things in different ways, in different contexts. But basically, Plato said, necessity is the mother of all innovations, basically. Then Albert Einstein said something like, well, sometimes when you have a crisis, when you have problems, is when some opportunities will arise. And then Mariana Pargendler said, well, why the Global South has innovated in corporate law? And she said, because they were required to, because the insufficient state capacity, all the institutional problems, the problems of inequality were not solved by the authorities that were supposed to solve the problem. So why not maybe relying on corporate law to deal with that? So, and I think it's a very, very good point. Maybe necessity sometimes has led to all of these creative, innovative solutions that we can observe from the Global South. So just to conclude, my point here is not saying that the Global South has a very good insolvency regime. Actually, I have an entire book published by Cambridge University Press saying that insolvency law in the Global South needs to be entirely reinvented. What I'm saying here and this is not about insolvency, this is about any area of law, is that we can learn from each other. Because sometimes we all face similar problems everywhere. So we cannot just limit ourselves to study a couple of jurisdictions, because that is going to limit the universe of ideas that can help us think about the design and the improvement of our own legal regimes. So that's all. Thank you so much for your attention. And I'm very happy now to take any question. I very much look forward to the discussion.